the only pure thing in this world. The fire came from the mountain. Burnt our forest. My people cried for help. But Eva did not come.
I'm recording.
I'm recording.
And I've clapped. Let's get this show on the road.
All right. All right. Hey, folks, welcome back once again to Podcast Part 3, the Part 3 Podcast. We're jumping right in. We are interrupting our little holiday bum around Middle Earth to bring you the hottest and freshest threequel on the streets. We are talking about Tarzan the Ape Man in the Kingdom of the Cat People, a.k.a. Avatar, Fire, and Ash.
James Cameron's first threequel, Sam. He's done a number of sequels, but he's never done a threequel, so...
One. I think Way of Water and Fire and Ash are just meant to be one movie, and if he does in fact never make Avatar 4 and 5, which would be his intended third movie to tell, one that because they'll presumably be one singular story as well, then he will indeed still get out of the franchise after the second part.
I have a wild theory about this. I've been wrestling with this movie, Sam.
This movie is, like, just come out. Spoilers abound, most likely.
Yes, we're gonna be spoiling all three Avatar movies, so go see the new one if you have 3.5 hours on that you have available to you, and we'll be here when you get back.
If you're gonna go see an Avatar movie, fucking see it in the theater, because it's a sumptuous experience, to say the least.
But I've been wrestling with this movie a lot. I think there's a lot in it that I really, really loved and I really, really like. And my big sort of conspiracy theory is that in order to make Way of Water a complete movie and this a complete movie, he had to rejigger the whole both movies so that there wasn't like sort of a cliffhanger. I think that's my conspiracy theory, my galaxy brain take.
Well, the second one ends, and forgive me, I've kind of seen it in like non-consecutive, not entirely in order chunks at this point, but it kind of ends with it's the story's concluded for the moment, but it is kind of like, but the fight continues on.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and it ends that way, but it also on like an emotional level, everyone sort of has had their emotional arcs sort of completed. Some of them have had, are sort of a little, have ellipses, but most of them end with a period, especially with Jake Sully and I want to say Nataya. It's either Nataya or Loak. I can't remember. Whichever son didn't die at the end of Way of Water.
Will. You've got me for 3 character names, 4 at the max, before I'm just naming actors or saying that kid.
Anyway, the kid who doesn't die at the end of Way of Water, he and Jake Sully, his father, have basically, they have an emotional catharsis at the end of that movie that is completely retconned at the beginning of this movie. So it feels like in order to make them 2 complete movies with their own sort of goals and themes and arcs, he decided to create a button for the end of one movie, but then had to kind of backtrack to make this other movie work. And I feel like they were more combined and enmeshed initially. That's my galaxy brain take.
I mean, that's not that crazy. I mean, we're talking about the 2 towers into the Return of the King, and those had to move a bunch of pieces around to make one work and the other work, you know, in concert with each other. And, you know, I think James Cameron's stories can be accused of being simplistic, but he's, you know, he knows his how to structure things pretty well.
Yeah.
I guess we should wind the clock back to 2009 and the light that burned twice as bright and half as long that was the Avatar phenomenon. It's fitting that we're talking about this in between 2 Lord of the Rings or 2 Middle Earth movies, because the Lord of the Rings movies are what inspired Cameron, or at least made him feel confident enough to go after this. And this has been his pet project. This was his pet project, I think, basically from the moment Titanic was done.
Yeah, I mean, I think even before Titanic, I think he had, like, the idea for this in, like, 1994. Like, I think he had a treatment for it, but was like, there's no way to do this without it being so cost prohibitive. So he just kind of waited until the special effects caught up. And then once he saw what Peter Jackson did, he was like, oh, I think now's the time.
I think he saw Gollum and he was like, okay, I can do this.
Yeah, exactly.
I think we talked about last week just sort of like a movie being super earnest, and the Avatar movies feel sort of like equal parts earnest and cynical, but it is like, I mean, there's an earnest to them in that they are essentially, having watched this new one and thought about the other two long enough, they're like, they really are that in the vein of like a very earnest Western. A revisionist Western that still wants to be an old, like, if they'd made it in 1988, Jake Sully would be Kevin Costner. Like, this one especially, I was like, oh, I'm just watching Last of the Mohicans. That's what this is.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely has that vibe, and sort of the emotions are big. The, you know, the story is simple. It's big. It's operatic. It's like everything's playing for the cheap seats, you know what I mean? Like, it's just, everything is huge. And I think that's kind of a feature, not a bug, personally. I think had these movies had a more complicated story, or, you know, had something like Dune in terms of how dense the story would be, I think your brain might explode.
If
it was, like, as confusing as Tenet, I think, like, you'd just... like, because the visuals are so dense, the story has to be so simple that your one part of your brain needs to sort of turn off a little bit.
These movies are not necessarily all humans bad, all Na'vi good, but they definitely are. All the bad people are bad, and all the good people are good. Character-wise, yes. And when any one of them tries to branch out from that, the movie pushes them back. It's a very, it's very simple. It doesn't even have necessarily the like a character of with any sort of, besides Jake Sully in like the first movie. There's no conflict with any internal conflict with most of the characters beyond like their relationship arcs, essentially. Like, you don't have, Boromir in this story. There's no,
you know. Yeah, I mean, the closest you get is Spider, and it barely there.
Not in the one I just saw.
Well, in Way of Water, there's a...
he got to first base, maybe second with that cat girl. I saw it happen, Will.
Well, no, in, he got in there Way of Water...
that 18-year-old boy... got together with that 70-year-old woman playing a teenage cat person. I saw it with my own eyes, Will, and you know what? It kind of worked.
These movies are also pants-crapping insane. For as simple as they are truly kind of bananas in how many, like, weird sci-fi, like, nonsense it throws at you.
I guess I keep coming back to that moment. First of all, because it was going to happen eventually. They were going to have a cat lady and a human and kiss each other or something, because it didn't happen the first time around. But also, I was just like, these movies, it was a weird, like, oh, I'm seeing two, like, teenage characters acting like teenagers and being like kind of weird and horny, and I was like, oh, that's like that's more genuine than you get from these movies. Typically, all the characters are very, very stoic and very, very like, it's like the whole world is, even when there's bad stuff in the world, everything is very Saturday morning cartoon. Like, if this could also be an 80s cartoon where it's like, you know, every week they take, they foil the villainous Quaritch, you know?
No. I mean, there is sort of a lot of that. And I mean, I think part of that is because Cameron took inspiration from the Edgar Rice Burroughs Mars stories for Avatar. And basically the story engines of those books are John Carter gets himself stuck in a jam, gets captured, escapes, rinse and repeat for almost an entire novel. And that's kind of how the Avatar movies
joke, but yeah, there is Edgar Rice Burroughs, man. There's a fucking Tarzan in this movie.
No, I mean, but that's, and that's, yeah, and it's a lot of sort of that, like, pulp soup, which also brings with it a lot of sort of the problematic aspects of that,
look,
of those,
I can't,
those stories.
I think a lot of people had an issue with it with Avatar, and it holds over to these ones, the sort of white savior thing, and
yeah,
the air quotes noble savage trope. I think the only reason I can single out Avatar for that is that it's came out way later than a lot of those movies were doing that anymore, and these movies also cost like more money than any one person ever deserves, so you know. Yeah. I get where the frustration comes from, but it is also just like by this one that's sort of moved past that, and it's there's maybe at least they've built out the world enough that the world of Pandora feels, you know, a little more lived in and a little more realistic to me.
Yeah, I think what's really smart about this one is bringing in a tribe of Na'vi who just don't buy into sort of the hippie bullshit.
No.
They're like, we don't believe in any of that. We got
Avatar 3. What if some of the Na'vi were dicks?
Exactly. What if some of the Na'vi were assholes? We're the bad guys.
But we're also pretty horny.
Really?
So
not pretty horny. So horny.
They're going to make you do peyote and do tail stuff. And
Una Chaplin is just vamping. It doesn't even like begin to describe her performance.
I want to see the behind the scenes stuff of her and Stephen Lang.
So,
just the most incredible.
So badly.
Incredible,
so badly. It's like watching a black box theater production at Hampshire.
I want to go back in time and show Charlie Chaplin what his granddaughter's up to in 2025.
It's amazing. It is amazing.
And it works.
This movie
is so
crazy. And that's the insane thing, it works.
When it gets weird is when it gets interesting. I didn't like in the first one, at the end of the day, I didn't care about the romance, and I didn't really care about Jake Sully because he's so stock and so milquetoast, and you never doubt which way he's gonna end up going. And right. I like that, like when these things get like, even when it's silly and it's kind of hard to wrap your head around, I'm fine with if these movies get a little freaky and a little weird, because they can do anything they want visually. Like these are,
yeah.
Like we've just watched it. We're going to talk about it next time. Like Battle of the Five Armies. And then this, like for all my criticisms of the Avatar movies, these are visually incredible.
I mean, yeah.
There's never at any point where it's also hard to follow what's going on beyond like the overwhelmingness necessarily of the like world you're in. Like it's, Cameron, in my opinion, for a guy I feel like I give a lot of crap to when we talk about like Avatar or Titanic, I actually don't think he's ever made a bad movie.
No, I agree.
Piranha 2 aside,
he's
made some okay movies, some like kind of formulaic movies. He's made some movies I don't love, but I would not call any one of his movies bad.
Yeah, I agree. I think he is very much of his, like the generation of him and like Spielberg and Lucas. He's one of those guys who just seems to understand how movies work on a granular level and knows how to construct a sequence so that it is just so like crystal clear on exactly what's
happening.
He's
got that Kubrickian perfectionist streak to him, which
right.
I know makes him not easy to work with, but at the same time, he's not going to make something unless it's exactly what he wants it to be. So like,
right.
If he's said about Avatar 4 and 5, if new one doesn't make a ton of money, we might not make 4 and 5. But I also think if he couldn't get it to work right, like in the production, I don't think he'd make Avatar 4 and 5 unless he was happy with them.
No, I think you're absolutely right. I think this is an idea he also like had bubbling in his head since he was like a teenager too. So he like had the like wherewithal to sit down and start writing the thing in 1994, and then realized, oh, we can't do this. This isn't possible right now. And then finally sat down to do it. And like, and you look at Avatar: Way of Water, which was supposed to come out in what, 2013, and didn't come out until 2022. Like, there's a reason for that. I mean, part of it is like COVID and
a lot
like
of that's a lot of things, but.
Right, but So I think a good chunk of it is, no, it's not ready yet. We can't do it. It's not where I want it to be, you know, so.
Yeah, he played the long game with his passion project, which is why his got made and wasn't bad and made $1 billion. Two plus billion dollars worldwide.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's he's a weird guy. And one of the things that I think I find deeply funny about the Avatar movies is how they're so, like, so, oh, we must get in touch with nature. But there's also, he loves, like, showing off the like, tech in his movies. Like, all the war machines, like, moving around and do it. He loves showing that off in such a way. It's, like, almost pornographic how much he loves that kind of stuff.
He's been playing with those visuals since Terminator.
No, I know,
he loves the industrial setting. Like, he, like, yeah. In this new one, like, in the first movie, it's just, like, a military base. In this one, by now, they've built this whole city, and I was just city. Like, okay, it's LV-426, you know?
Yeah,
It's just, like, it's a terraforming facility, you know?
Yeah, it's in the, God, I mean, these movies are wild, and, like I said, I've been wrestling with this one, because I love so much of it, but I just, it's the repetitive nature of it that sort of, irks me a little bit on the story level.
I think this whole franchise might actually, I think it will depend on what 4 and 5 are. Like,
yeah,
is this going to go in a more, you know, maybe more naive but optimistic way where they finally do drive the humans away? Or is it going to be kind of a darker, more downbeat ending? Because it's like, can they beat them back forever?
Well, and
will Giovanni Ribisi ever learn his lesson?
There's something actually in this movie, and it's a tiny, tiny part of it where they talk about sort of, it's actually the sentient space whales that are, like, are super smart and have, like, music and a culture and everything. Another wild idea that's just sort of, like, in the movie.
Free Willies, yep.
The Free Willies. The Free Willies that are also, like, E.T., but also, like, the creatures from the abyss. Anyway.
I think of them as the polar bears from the Golden Compass.
Ah, that's perfect. Yeah. That's a perfect analogy. Anyway, they talk about, the idea is that they don't like killing because it just creates more killing. So there's this little thread in there about sort of how cycles of violence sort of repeat. And I do kind of think that that might be where it's sort of going, is it's like, how do you break this cycle? It's like you just kill one side and then the other side comes back stronger and then vice versa.
I think
that might be where 4 and 5,
yeah,
is going.
I think it's both sides are going to have, like, this, the villains in this are so stock. Like, in this one, it's like, yeah. So Stephen Lang's character is killed, human character is killed in the first one. He comes back in the second two as his memories put into a Na'vi body. And he's sort of now more, he has a sense of what this planet is and Awa, the goddess that sort of connects everything. And he never at any point really has, like, an eye-opening moment, because he's too, he gets too enamored with the fire tribe and all the weird shit they're getting into.
He's just so horny, he's just so horny.
She's like,
it's Una Chaplin, man, vamping,
yeah,
around.
Yeah, just like, look. Long leggy cat people. They were
vamping around, smoking peyote, twirling their little knives around.
Look, these movies did what the Cats musical movie did not accomplish.
could never do. Make cats sexy.
Well, no, I think you can make cats. Everyone thinks cats are sexy. Andrew Lloyd Webber settled that years ago.
That's true.
No. Anyway, the point I was trying to make is none of the villains ever have a moment of, like, or what is like, every now and then you have, like, one throwaway line from, like, individual characters might realize, oh, what I'm doing is wrong, like Jemaine Clement's character or the guys from the first movie, or, you know, but there's, like, in general, only now and then do you have one character will occasionally just sort of be like, what are we doing? Like, what? Like, we're still going to go after them. They just killed everyone. What are we doing?
What are you doing?
And then you just have Giovanni Ribisi in the Paul Reiser role every single movie when they explain to him, like, oh, there's a symbiotic nature. Like, everything's connected. And he's just like, come on. Come on. What are you talking about?
He's just like, fuck off.
And it's like, it's so, on one level, it's just like, I love this man who cannot learn a lesson. This man just, like, can't. cannot, will not, like learn from his mistakes. But I do wonder.
Yeah, just absolutely refuses.
But I do wonder if you're going to need that from a human character. And the problem is, I don't think they have a human character that's been established that can do that.
Yeah, because all of them are, like you say, are so stock, and I think they might need to, in the extended cut of the first Avatar, you see a little bit of Earth, but I wonder if they're going to actually end up going to Earth at some point, and like actually having extended sequences on Earth. I don't know. Are the Na'vi going to show up at Earth?
Reverse Avatar?
Put a Na'vi in a
Zoe Saldana body? Anything's possible.
One of the loopiest sci-fi concepts in blockbuster movies, I think, is this idea that people have basically a USB cable attached to their head, and they can download their memories into literal God anywhere on the planet. Like, it's kind of insane.
I mean, it's insane, but at the same time, is it that far-fetched from, like, a Matrix concept or Existenz or something like that?
No, it's not. But I think it is, like, but making it an organic type of thing is just, it's cool. I guess insane is really the wrong. It's just a loopy sort of hippy-dippy sci-fi concept.
Oh, it's so hippy-dippy. Idea that came out of someone in the mid to late 70s, but, you know, it's
like this, like, dorkily earnest, you know, sort of boomer,
I mean,
environmental epic.
It feels like one of those paperbacks that, you know, fucking George McFly would have been writing.
Right, you know, yeah, exactly, like, yeah.
But it is, I mean, I think that's, like, I was talking about this before we saw it. It is, like, every director at this, when you're an auteur who's made hugely successful, critical, and financially successful movies, gets to that point where they can say, like, I want to make some movie that's not going to make you any money, and it's a passion project of mine, but you're going to do it because I'm me, and you can't say no to me. And that's, like, right. You know, David Fincher's like, I'm going to make a movie about, you know, Mankiewicz. Or, you know, Steven Spielberg's like, I want to make, you know, my movie about the Washington Post or something like that, you know?
Right.
This is that for James Cameron. It just happens to be that it cost $400 million to make, and it made $2 billion. But I don't think – I think – and this is part of the reason why it kind of comes into the cultural zeitgeist and then leaves just as quickly, is that I don't think he said as much. I don't think he cares about cultural impact. He's like, I want you to see this movie in the theater. That's all I care about.
Yeah, no, I think you're right, and I think he does have, like, messages he wants to impart. I think he does have, you know, he's big into sort of the environmental of it, but I think you're right, and I think it's all about, like, this big spectacle that he wants to tell, and it's not like Lucas, who had this, you know, sort of genius idea to commercialize Star Wars. Cameron sort of doesn't care. There is a comic book, there is a video game, there's been toy lines over the years, but they never really, like, hit, and it doesn't seem like Cameron really, like, and there's the theme park ride.
There's no Disney Plus animated series, you know.
Right. I mean, and you know, you'd think, had Avatar come out in the 90s, like, when we were growing up, there would be, like, a dedicated toy line and an animated series and, you know, all sorts of, you know, and novels and all sorts of associated nonsense with it. But Cameron just doesn't seem to care. I think you're right. I think it's like he wants people to experience this giant spectacle, like sort of the biblical epics from the 60s, and then kind of like go on with their
day. They don't make them anymore, but this is a 70mm roadshow movie, if there ever was one.
Exactly, yeah.
You know, it's long. It's no longer than, like, your longer superhero or, like, those kind of movies these days. But.
Yeah. Yeah, it's 3.5 hours, I think, and maybe a little bit longer.
I will say, it's never boring. It moves.
No.
Like, there's enough going on. Like, structurally, this one is very strange, but it's, you know, I didn't find it boring at all.
Yeah, well, I think it's on, I think that's the problem on the story level, is that it's kind of recycling a bunch of stuff from the other two movies. And I think in a lot of ways, Sam, this is the ultimate threequel we've covered on this show. I think this is the one that, like, takes everything from a threequel that, and it just, it's like, no one seems tired aside from that, but it's sort of, it's just sort of like taking bits and pieces from the first two movies and recycling them. It's the sort of the Return of the Jedi of it all.
It does have a little bit of that, you know, in a big budget fashion, a little bit of that, is this anything anymore? Like, what's left to say, you know?
Exactly. I mean, this is a trilogy ender, sort of.
Sort of. I'm the more I think about it, the more I'm just like, are the last two movies of this trilogy just both like a Deathly Hallows thing where they're meant to be two separate parts? You know, I'm starting to wonder if he visualizes this as a trilogy of stories that happen to be across five movies.
Yeah, I mean, I think you might be right.
Because we've talked about this. Threequels, part threes, can happen anywhere in a franchise. It's just a movie. It's a story that comes after two other stories.
Right, right.
And it has to come after, at the minimum, two other movies.
Well, like your Star Trek 4 exactly. is a part three, yeah.
Halloween 7.
Halloween 7. But in that way, it's sort of how it's taking sort of elements from the first two movies and reiterating on them. And it's sort of like, oh, now we're going to do the air battle from the first movie. But the bad guys are also flying, you know, the dragons, you know, or it's
when are all the animals going to rise up? When are those squid guys we saw at the end of the second act going to turn, you know?
I did not like those squid guys.
You didn't
guys.
Like the squidmen?
I did not
didn't
like
those,
I don't
those
like
angry
squids. You know my feelings about squids. They freak me out.
Yeah, but
it's okay.
They killed all the bad men. You know,
no, I know, but they were scary looking.
I know. That planet sucks. That planet's like the planet from Predator Badlands. It's just like I'd be there for 20 minutes and I'd be like, fuck this place.
I want to leave. I don't Why care do we want to terraform this planet? Is there any other planet
I
we can terraform?
I don't care how valuable the ambergris and these whales are.
This is not worth my time.
Predator could show up in these movies, you know. It's under the same umbrella.
Listen, if this had come out in the 90s, there absolutely would have been an Avatar versus Predator comic.
Oh, for sure.
Absolutely, 100%.
Oh, God.
And aliens as well.
A Na'vi gets a face hugger, you know. Yep. Oh, shit.
It would be a whole thing. It would have been the whole thing.
Yep.
There would have been like four issues.
Lucas would have put couple of them in the Imperial Senate, you know.
Just for funsies, you know.
Na'vi meets E.T.
It's just, you know, that's the thing.
And I think that's also part of it is like, I like that the movies, this one's getting a little freakier, a little hornier, because I also think it's, and we're going to talk about this with The Hobbit next week with the elf dwarf romance. I think it's more fun when at least one half of one of these interspecies movie couples isn't sexy. Like, if it was, if Zoe Saldana was playing an E.T. alien, I think that's way more interesting and way weirder, and it makes people way more uncomfortable because they're probably still pulled into the story.
Right.
So it's like, you know, we're going to talk about in The Hobbit, it's like Evangeline Lilly's character falls in love with the one dwarf who's just like, just the prettiest man. He's just a pretty man who happens to be short. Instead of one of
the prettiest
like a Gimli looking guy, which I think would have been more, I think people would have gravitated to that more because of what a swing it was.
Yeah, I think, yeah, well, we'll get to it, but yeah, I think so. I mean, of that misbegotten plot line, I think, yes, I think that would have made it a little more, at least interesting, instead of a weird love triangle with Lego. We'll get there.
That being said, I don't know if the Avatar movies need to swap out the Na'vi for some sort of Ewok-looking. They all should look like, not the Ewoks, but remember Battle for Endor? You remember Wilfred Brimley's little friend?
Vaguely.
Yeah, he looks like, he's kind of looks like, he looks a little like, not Gwildor, the Billy Barty stand-in for Gwildor in Masters of the Universe.
That is Gwildor.
Whatever.
That is Gwildor. You're thinking Orko.
Orko, right. I'm sorry, everybody. I'm so sorry. I'm not up on my He-Man.
God, get it right!
I have to wait for that next movie to come out.
Oh, boy. Yes.
Give another part.
Jared Leto sleepwalking through a movie as Skeletor.
That was like the biggest. I was looking through that. Remember they announced that cast? And I was looking through there. I was like, Oh, that's great. All right, I like that. Ooh, Alison Brie. That's great. Like,
Evil-Lyn, yeah.
Fuck off, Jared Leto.
Come on.
Go away. Like,
yeah, who you want, like, somebody, like, really, who would really chew the scenery for Skeletor. Like, and I feel like...
Better example, that new Street Fighter teaser. Gave it David Dasmalchian. I'm saying his name wrong, but you know he's bringing it. He's bringing Raul Julia energy to that part.
And that's what you need. That movie needs to be goofy as shit. It can't be serious. And like,
well, I think that's the thing with these movies, and this is something people talk about with the prequels. It's that we gravitate also towards a Han Solo type of character who is going to be the audience surrogate.
Exactly.
You know, not necessarily like taking a piss out of the whole story, but just being like, what are you talking about? Where did you dig up that old fossil? And I think one of the challenges of the Avatar movies is they don't have that character. Like, Jake Sully is that character initially, but he's, you know, he's not played like a Han Solo.
Right, he's not roguish enough, and he's just too serious. He's got too much of, like, John Carter in his DNA, so he's too, like, serious. He's just too serious.
He's such a doofus in the first one, too. Like,
yes, he's also kind of a dope.
He's such a doofus. You know, it's like... I never have glommed on to the Jake Sully character, including in this new one. It's like he's just, and I don't think it's Sam Worthington's fault. I think he's doing what is asked of him performance-wise. Like, he's the stoic father figure now, but it's like he's surrounded by just characters that are getting into weirder, more interesting stuff.
Yeah, and I think it's better served in the second movie. I think a lot of his sort of reluctant messiah stuff works a lot better in the second movie. And him being like an overprotective dad also works a lot better in the second movie. And I think makes Jake Sully a lot more interesting as a character in that respect. And then this movie sort of rewinds a lot of the stuff that you do with him. And I think him and Quaritch are a little more intriguing, have a more intriguing relationship here.
I agree, yeah.
Mainly because they interact a lot.
Well,
it's,
you know, that's always one way to go. You get to a certain point where your hero and your villain have to team up. And there is a bit of that in this. And then they kind of take Quaritch in a different direction. But he always is like, he has his human son that he obviously cares about on some level. But the movie, when it gets to the point where the narratively they have nowhere else to go with Quaritch but to have him realize what he's doing is wrong, they literally just have him jump off a cliff into the abyss. I have a feeling we haven't seen the last of him.
Yeah, I think you're right.
I think he's going to become more of, and he kind of becomes this by the end of this, he's going to be, if there is a 4 and 5 third chapter, he's now the same role as Agent Smith in Revolutions. He's the he's the chaos agent now.
Yeah, I think he's gonna be the one who's going to be like corrupting Awa in a way. I think you're right.
Because I don't think Una Chaplin's character dies either.
No, she just
she gets Sigourney Weaver does the get away from her you bitch line to her and scares
her
off.
And connects her with her USB tail and freaks her out.
I guess we got to talk about Sigourney Weaver in this movie.
Okay, so I think Sigourney Weaver is incredible in these two movies. I think she's actually a pretty great... Like, I think there are certain times where I think she credibly plays 16 or 17 years old.
I think the visual effect of her teenage character actually works better than the Navi, adult Sigourney Weaver Navi from the original.
I agree.
I think because that one's too uncanny valley. This one is way more subtle. And the only thing that throws me is the voice.
Yeah, and I don't know exactly what it is, because in the second one, I didn't feel that. So I didn't feel it all the time here. So there must have been like a sound pitching thing that, I don't know, didn't sort of
maybe the
work
pitching they
all
just
the way,
felt
I don't know,
affected her performance or something.
Or maybe it didn't work in the mixing. Yeah. Maybe they had to, I don't know.
Like, the performance is fine. Like, she's bringing the energy of a younger person. And her character, you know, has this big arc where she's got to risk her life to reconnect with Awa. And, you know, she's got to very strange romance going on. And, you know, like, it's she's a big swing. Like, if you can't make her work visually and performance-wise, then you're done. The character just doesn't.
Yeah, the whole movie and half the movie sort of falls apart, I think, for a
lot of that is what kind of people took, were the silliest parts of the original, were some of the Uncanny Valley stuff with the
right.
Avatar Navi.
Well, and I think that might have just been sort of the technology just bumping up as far as it could go, you know, as it's getting up to its limitations at the time. I don't know.
Maybe they also just readjusted how they designed them, because, like, there's a bunch of name actors playing Navi in these, but it's like, you wouldn't, unless you knew they were in the movie, you wouldn't necessarily pick out Kate Winslet, Cliff Curtis, David Thewlis.
David Thewlis. I didn't even realize he was in the movie until his name popped up in the credits.
And like, and then if then someone tells you, you're kind of like, oh, okay, I remember. I can. It's like from the nose down, you kind of get it.
Yeah, it does seem like they redesigned. I don't know how very subtly it seems. But it seems like a lot of the Na'vi were redesigned to be maybe a little more cat-like, a little more alien, a little less human.
I think the body shapes are less uniform now too. I think we're seeing different tribes and all that, but it's like some are, you know, more muscular, some are more curvaceous. We've got a pregnant one. We've got, I feel like in the original movie they were all pretty much, you know, the same, like, long, lean swimmer's body. And I think they're just, you know, they're building out the world, and you can, when you do that, you have to create some sort of variety. It's the right. saving grace of the prequels, and it's one of the best things about these movies.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, it's, yeah, I don't know. It's nobody's doing it like Cameron. No one's making movies like this big and this meticulous and this, you know, sort of granular.
I think this is, I mean, but also, like, this is the make or break one, and he's been coy about how he feels this one's going to do. I don't think it's going to make as much as the last two, but I think it'll still ideally it's still going to be a huge hit.
Yeah, I think I agree. I think there's two things sort of riding against it, and I think it's the time frame between the last one and this one, I think, is too short. It's 3 years is actually sort of a perfect amount of time between, a prequel and a sequel. But I do think that there was the 13 years between Avatar and Way of Water, I think, did bring up a lot of anticipation is sort of the wrong word, because it's not like Avatar was like, again, had a big cultural presence, but I do think a lot of people were like, well, what's Cameron going on? What's he cooking up? I want to see.
I think it's also just like, we were all like, is he actually going to make
this? Right. Or is this ever going to happen? Yeah. Cause they kept getting delayed.
Or is he just going to keep Sam Worthington in a warehouse in Manhattan Beach for the next decade?
That's true. Cause that second movie kept getting delayed. So it was, it was sort of like, I don't know if this ever is going to get made.
As successful as it was, I don't think the second one necessarily like had the cultural explosion of the first one.
It did. I mean, I think it did and it didn't. I think a lot of people liked the second one more than the first one, or at least critics did. I don't know. I think, I don't know. It also came out in a weirder time, sort of.
The landscape, everything's different between 2009 and 2022.
It was sort of like coming out of the end of COVID, so people were like more like, oh, big movie, cool, you know, mm-hmm. So... I don't know. I think you might be right, though. I think this one is probably going to be the lesser of the two. This is always comes with a Cameron movie since, like, 1991. Everyone's like, well, this is going to flop, and then, you know, never does. So
yeah, he's never had... Have any of his movies underperformed? The Abyss?
That's the only one.
And then he was like, all right, well, check this out, Terminator 2, you know?
It's like, Terminator 2, most expensive movie ever made. Everyone's like, oh, it's going to flop.
In our lifetime, he's made, before Avatar, what's going on? Is that your cats?
The cat is getting into a box. I don't, keep talking.
Avatar 4.
Avatar 4, cat in a box.
Avatar 4, he's like, it's just cat footage from his house.
Well, you know, Avatar 3 didn't make the money we wanted, so this is what I made.
Aliens, The Abyss, Terminator 2, True Lies, and Titanic, leading up to every single one of those was some level of huge deal.
Right. I mean, and
certainly at least two of those were like the only thing people talked about for a year after they came out.
I mean, Terminator 2, I think, was the most successful movie of all time at the time. And then Titanic was the most successful movie of all time.
And Titanic was successful in a way that you're never going to see again, where it was the number one movie for weeks upon week. Fit, what, 15, 16
Something
weeks?
Something like that. I mean, it was,
it just came kept out because people kept December going
December into, like, March.
Back.
Yeah, it was.
And it had this a massive cross-demographic appeal. Like, I wasn't into it. I was 11. It was too much kissing. I wanted more boat sinking and more less kissing. But you know, it's monumental.
Yeah,
that movie.
No, I mean it's Titanic as a phrase.
But it is also another feels like a early to mid 20th century like roadshow movie.
Right.
It feels like the kind of movies they'd stopped making even by the
90s. Yeah. I mean, like, what would the last one of those be like? Dances with Wolves, kinda, right? I mean,
even still, like, Dances with Wolves is a pretty small movie compared to Titanic. I'm thinking, like, the ones, like, the kinds where if it bombs, it kills
right,
a studio.
Like Cleopatra.
Like Cleopatra.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But, like, Sound of Music or something like that. Those they were usually musicals, like My Fair Lady or Mary Poppins or things like that.
Yeah, no.
But, you know, like, when they would be a flop, it was like, okay,
deal.
we got to sell a chunk of our property, you know?
Just to recoup our losses, yeah.
And there's studios, for good and bad reasons, do not gamble on a single movie like that anymore.
No. Yes. Yeah, so I don't know. And it's sort of been interesting to see, because how Disney has been doing with the, you know, Avatar movies in the Disney era.
I also would make a guess that if this one doesn't do so hot and Cameron kind of steps away, you're going to see a little bit more ancillary stuff.
I think you're probably right. And I think, I mean, Cameron for a while was very bullish, being like, the Avatar movies are going to be the only things I'm going to make. Everything I need to say and about cinema and life or whatever is going to be in these movies. And now he's been like, well, I want to do this Ghosts of Hiroshima movie. So I'm wondering if he's going to hand the reins over
every
to somebody
director,
else.
Every director gets that George Lucas itch eventually where they're like, I just want to go back to my garage and make the first Terminator on a Roger Corman budget. Just to see. I
just
think a lot of them was like,
can I still have it?
You know? You talk about, like, one of the big things at the beginning of, like, prestige television were, like, guys like Scorsese and Sam Raimi, to a certain degree, like, would go make a, you know, Scorsese did, like, the pilot of Boardwalk Empire,
right.
And he was like, oh my god, this is so refreshing to, like, kind of scale it way back.
Yeah, well, I remember when Drag Me to Hell came out, that was sort of what Sam Raimi was like, I just kind of want to go back to my roots and, like, do a small thing, you know? I mean, I think that was right around...
He's got that new movie coming out.
Send Help? Yeah.
Yeah. I saw the trailer and I'm like, oh, I mean, I like an unhinged Rachel McAdams. That sounds fun.
Yeah.
You know?
She doesn't get the chance to play all that much. She gets such thankless roles.
Game Night is so good. I love
Game
Night.
Oh, she's so good in Game Night too. Yeah.
Yeah. Those guys, they did that and they did the Dungeons and Dragons movie and they were both great and they didn't, like, they were so poorly marketed.
Yeah.
It just bums me out.
Yeah, it's a shame. But Game Night, she is so good in Game Night. But she always just gets stuck as, like, it's Doctor Strange's girlfriend. Yeah. And, like, that's all she gets.
Well, she does a lot of dramas,
too.
She's in that, we've been talking about lately, my Hall of Fame of actors you think about, and you think, oh, they'd be really good as an MCU hero. Oh, wait, they used them already.
Right.
Like, when you remember, oh, man, how come Walton Goggins hasn't played an MCU villain?
Oh, he did in Ant-Man 2.
Yeah.
He's just kind of there.
Idris Elba hasn't been in the MCU. Oh, no, wait, he was in, like, six of them. As just one of Thor's friends.
As the gatekeeper to Asgard. Why? Natasha Lyonne. Oh, right. She's in Fantastic Four as just there.
She's someone that you care about that's down in the mole man's world
right,
during
right.
the big fight
yeah.
so that you can cut to angles of. Yeah, I mean, also, like, seeing this on the big screen, it is just, like, the TLC that goes into the visuals. You don't, I mean, that's been a big problem with blockbusters lately. Right. Like, they haven't, they've looked a little more rough around the edges, and they've looked, like, they have been rushed, and, you know, they felt incomplete on certain levels.
Well, and so much of, like, the MCU in particular has just felt like factory line. They're not bad. I don't want to say they're bad, but they just feel so like corporatized, and just sort of like this came off the shelf and here you go. And like
they've felt directionless.
Right, well that too.
Since Endgame, it feels like they were going in one direction and then they had to wildly gear shift, and now we know where they're going, but it's a weird the weird Robert Downey Jr. thing. We don't know how that's
going to turn out. Right, because they haven't built up to it kind of at all. So it's
and it's like what? It's the next movie?
Yeah, it's coming out.
Well, there's a Spider-Man.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. That's right.
Which is fine. It's Spider-Man. I don't worry about him. He's going to be
usually okay. But no,
he's hanging out with the Hulk and the Punisher.
And Sadie Sink, right? She's in that.
Who's as
probably,
I mean, I guess
Jean
a different
Grey
Mary
or,
Jane.
I don't know. Somebody.
No. Is she going to be Felicia
Hardy?
What
I'm hoping is that Spider-Man gets gets two roommates, one of whom is Iceman and the other whom is Firestar.
Oh, yes. Fuck yes. Oh, Will, you cracked it. Call Feige. Tell him to stop production if he hasn't.
That would make me so happy
Does she have a Shih Tzu?
Yes, she should. I would be so happy if they did Spider-Man and his amazing friends, because that's like a perfect MCU setup, and like the comedy just writes itself. Come on.
Yeah, that's actually like a really good idea. That's really, God damn. We're printing money over here at Podcast Part 3, folks. Come on down. We got ideas.
But what I was saying is a lot of the MCU, and, you know, Feige, hire me after I do this big criticism, is that the MCU feels very sort of like off the shelf, kind of just run of the mill in a lot of ways, except for my beloved Thunderbolts this year. But
and I mean, I think we say that, but then you can point to exceptions. Thunderbolts, Guardians 3.
True. Yeah.
You know, I think these are the things. I only criticize the MCU because they've made so many movies I've really enjoyed, right. And it's like the fact that they exist at all is just a miracle compared to you go back to 2009 and tell us that, like, coming out of a screening of Avatar, that we're going to be griping about, you know, the Thunderbolts movie or talking about the third Guardians of the Galaxy movie, and Deadpool met Wolverine and they had a whole schmoz together.
Or the first Fantastic Four movie, yeah. In the MCU, well, not the first,
no.
But the first one in the MCU. Anyway,
they made one.
Yeah.
It's better. it's. I guess it's better.
It's better.
I think in 2009. Well, and Galactus is back. I'm like, is he a big purple man? Yes. Okay.
All
good,
right.
Good,
I'm all
good,
in.
Good. Go.
But it's just, they just feel sort of like, especially lately, a lot of blockbusters have felt sort of samey and with like no like really like no sort of take or a viewpoint on what they're doing. And it's one of the reasons, again, I brought this up maybe last week or the week before, I don't remember, why I loved Predator Badlands so much. It's like, it felt like somebody was like, I have an idea. Do you know what I mean?
And we were talking about Sinners recently, and it's like, it's not like Sinners is the most original idea. Sinners is a pair of brothers on the run from the law who end up besieged by vampires in a nightclub overnight. That's a movie that's pretty famously been made, but this one was done. You did it differently. You did it better, in my opinion.
It has a thematic idea behind it.
Yeah, it's got an identity of its own. Yeah. It's like, you know, it's whether or not they were consciously sort of lifting that idea or not, it doesn't matter. It was such a people just want some good shit, you know?
Well,
and it doesn't have to be like, no one's asking for us to go like completely too far afield. I think people just want to be entertained with a really, we've said it before, even if you're not going to reinvent the wheel, just make a really good wheel.
Well, and that's kind of, and we talked about this last week too, but I think that's why K-pop Demon Hunters is so popular as well. It's sort of like, it's not like K-pop Demon Hunters is a wildly original story or, you know, but it has like somebody, like, put some thought into what they were doing, and, like, let's make sort of the, with a unique sort of cultural twist to it, but it's like, you know, it's...
And some banger
and
songs.
And really good songs. Know? I mean, I think that helped a lot.
That's the thing. Also, every movie clicks for different reasons. Avatar is not a movie that people responded to because of the great script or the great, like, acting. It was because it was this visual experience that no one had ever seen before on the big screen for 3 hours in 3D, where it didn't give you a horrible headache.
Right. Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, exactly.
We'll talk about it more next week, but we do have to have a talk about that frame rate, though.
Yeah, so like Way of Water, this one also some of it is shot in 48 frames per second, and like Way of Water, it switches between a normal frame rate and the higher frame rate whenever Cameron sort of feels like the scene needs more movement. I really don't quite understand, except when he's underwater, I don't understand why you bother, but...
the problem is... And again, we're going to talk about this so much with Battle of the Five Armies, so we don't need to beat it to death here, but that frame rate creates sort of a weightlessness, and when it's a world that's completely computer generated, it then suddenly feels like you're watching a video game cutscene. Yeah. Like, the moments where it really stuck out for me were POV shots.
Yes, yes.
Oh. Where it felt like I was suddenly,
well, not
like,
even,
watching
not necessarily
a video
POV
game.
Shots. It was POV shots when there were, like, things on front of the frame, like a scope that, like, made...
Scope,
or when
peyote filter. And then the end where they go to the afterlife.
Oh, yes.
And
all
their friends are hanging out there. Yeah. Like, Sigourney Weaver's there as a human.
Sort of like, did feel like the end.
Lincoln's there.
The end of a video game where everyone is like, congratulations, you beat the level, you beat the game.
It works sometimes and it doesn't work other times. And the times where it doesn't work is jarring. I think it's better here than it was with the Hobbit movies.
Well, and I think it helps having not doing it the whole way through, because I think I couldn't handle that first Hobbit movie. Like, I got a migraine through the whole movie. So when he announced that he was doing this, and I was worried going into the Way of Water screening, because I was like, oh God, am I going to just sort of have a migraine through this whole thing? But because he didn't stick with it the whole time, it didn't hurt my eyes as much, and my brain wasn't like, I hate this.
Also, it's a whole completely virtual world, so he has way more control over how everything moves and how, you know, the depth of field and stuff. I remember with the first Hobbit, there'd be like, in the higher frame rate, you'd have these gorgeous like vistas and shots of New Zealand, because it's the kind of thing the frame rate you would use for like a nature show,
right.
A nature documentary. Right. But then you'd have this eagle fly through that was CG, and it would be moving in this weightless, fluid way, like clip art.
Yeah,
animation.
You could really, could really see the seams, and especially when it would be like close-ups on actors' faces, and it would be like, I can see like the paint and the glue and like everything. Yeah. You're like, what am I watching?
We're gonna get into it. That movie is, I don't want to be too mean to it, but it's coming off of watching Return of the King, and this movie, which is like a visual achievement.
Yeah.
It's gonna be, we're gonna have to. I'm not mad. I'm disappointed.
Why does it hurt so much, Sam?
Why
does it hurt so much?
Why does it hurt so much?
Because it was real.
The love you have for this cat person.
man.
So William, 1 to 3 stars.
I think. So like I said, I've been wrestling with this. I've actually been wrestling with what I was going to rate it on the show. So I think I'm going to give it a 3. I think overall I enjoyed it. I think my reservations are more at the script level. I think it goes with a 3. Maybe a soft 3.
I'm more inclined to go 2, but I will concede to a soft 3. Also, I think it needs to be said, I don't think we've seen the third narrative chapter yet. I think that's what 4 and 5 are going to be. This felt like the conclusion of an arc but not the conclusion of the entire story.
Yes, so I think in terms of the a threequel, I think you'd put it in like a saga threequel, not like a trilogy ender. A saga threequel.
The end of this felt like the end of the Two Towers to me, where it was like the battle for the Whale Cove is over, but the battle for Middle Earth is yet to begin, you know.
Yeah, I think that's about right.
Well, Will, I think all that's left to do in this year of our AWA 2025 is to talk about The Hobbit, The Battle of the Five Armies.
Oh boy.
And you know,
I can talk about how much it is, I hate the word necromancer, even though I don't actually hate the word. I hate the word necromancer in these movies.
And if anyone's going to like the word necromancer, it's
I don't have a problem with the word necromancer. I just have a problem with the necromancer in these movies. That's all.
And I'm going to talk about what are the physical symptoms of dragon sickness, or is it just a mental health problem?
So much to get into.
And We should do a challenge. Can you name all the dwarves in The Hobbit, or can you name 12 characters from Avatar: Fire and
Ash? I might be able to do it. Because I think it probably would be like, Jermaine Clement, that one guy who doesn't have an arm.
I can probably do five.
From Avatar or five dwarves?
From Avatar. Yeah. I can probably do all the dwarves because half their names just rhyme. You know, it's Jake Sully, there's Neytiri, there's Quaritch, there's Selfridge.
Yep, that's Giovanni
Ribisi's character. And the littlest kid is named Nuke.
Yes. Yes. And
I think that's all I got. Yeah. Oh yeah, I thought you were all right, Spider. I thought you said I'm all right, Spider. I was trying to remember his name before this, though. I was like, what was his name? Scotch? Scratchy? Something like
that. He's John Connor. I mean, like, that. The funniest thing about Spider, though, is that he is like John Connor from Terminator 2, just like with a Tarzan skin.
I mean, to his credit, that guy, I liked his performance. No, talk about, like, you've got the most thankless gig in Hollywood. You got to run around in a loincloth against, like, a bunch of actors in mocap suits.
It's actually pretty incredible.
All of whom are supposed to be, like, 3 feet taller than you as well.
And the other thing that's incredible about those scenes, though, is when he's running around, you're like, okay, the digital stuff is all not real. The actors are there. How are there no seams? How can I not, like, the seams are not, like, with the live action and they just cracked it, I guess. I don't, you know.
Yeah. I mean, it was pretty good in the original, and it's pretty seamless here. I mean, look, he spent, like, a decade and a half just fine-tuning this technology.
It's true.
That's all he's been doing. He's like, he put his name on a couple Terminators. He came out of his bunker to, like, give a couple, like, you know, if you like the original Terminator, Genesis is the one for you. Okay, I gotta go. Three years later, Mr. Cameron, could you come out and say that line you said, but now it's called Dark Fate.
He had a little bit more of a hand in that one, but basically. And Battle Angel Alita, too. Or Alita Battle
Angel. That's right.
Angel,
that was one of his movies that he was always going to do himself. It was that, and then there was, I think it was called Adrenaline.
Oh, yeah, there was
something
weird like that. Yeah.
He had, like, a couple of, like, anime or manga properties he was really into. But, like, this was, you know, he got a window to do these, and he's going to go as long as he's able. I'm not, you know what, good for him.
Yeah.
He's got nothing to prove. That's the thing.
No, he really doesn't.
He's trying to prove that this technology works to himself. Yeah. Like, he has... The man made Aliens, the man made the Terminators, the man made fucking Titanic. He has nothing to prove as a filmmaker to Hollywood. Yeah. You know, like, it's done. You know, his legacy is secure. These are just his personal projects. And the fact that they're insanely expensive is funny and fascinating and admirable and stressful to me all at the same time.
Yeah.
But, you know, and that I don't know if I connect to these movies the way other people do, but they are an achievement for sure. Yeah. To go back to where we were before, I'll give it 3 stars.
Yeah. Yeah. Like I said, a soft 3.
And I am genuinely intrigued, and I hope this one does well enough that we get 4 and 5, because I'd like to see how this story all wraps up. I want to see where it goes from here.
Yeah. same. I mean, I've been in the pocket for Avatar since 2009, but yeah.
I sat through 5 Transformers movies. I can make it through 2 more Avatars.
And those, talk about repetitive, those movies. Oy. Anyway, we'll get there. We'll get there one day.
We haven't gotten there. Oh, boy, oh, boy.
We'll get there.
Will, we got a lot of movies we got to get to in the new year. We got a whole bunch of stuff. We just got a text from our buddy FM who was like, I really liked Wake Up Dead Man. And I was like, oh, God, that's a threequel, too. I got to watch that.
So many. Too many, maybe, but...
And I should watch it because it's probably
pretty good.
Yeah,
you know,
like I can hold off on Tron Ares for a while, but you know,
we can wait till Tron Ares drops on Disney Plus to cover it. That's fine.
But yeah. Will, and folks, we will see you before the end of the year for The Hobbit. But until then, have a lovely Christmas.
Yes.
Have a lovely New Year's. A happy Hanukkah. Have a good holiday season all around. I hope you're having a good time. And Will, this was a delight. I we've been on the Avatar train together for a long time.
Yeah, I remember arguing about Avatar in our apartment on Ventura Canyon early one morning.
I think we
woke Daniel up and pissed him off, and he was like, "Shut the fuck up."
I think we think about it the same way we talk about Lord of the Rings. You go back, and even if not everything works visually. And I think with the original Avatar, I'll bet if I went back, it's still pretty damn flawless. I think we appreciate the time and care that
exactly.
went into it. Because it's not something you see every day, and it's you see less and less of it, you know. And, you know, I think we talked about this with Return of the King, and I think I stand by it now. Audiences respond to when they can pick up on filmmakers putting in an effort on their behalf.
Yeah, no, I think so. I think that's really it. And I think that's why, the you know, MCU hasn't been churning out billion-dollar hits anymore. I think everyone's kind of like, I don't know, I get what you're doing. It's the MCU thing. That's fine.
Yeah, I think people, you know, they want to feel wanted.
Exactly.
You know, they want the movie, they want to feel like the movie wants them there to watch it, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
And I think I'm coming down much more generously on this one than I did on the original in 2009.
Like I said, we woke Daniel up arguing once, and I think he yelled at us. He told us to shut up.
All right. Well, folks, again, have a happy holiday, and we will see you next time for The Hobbit, The Battle of the Five Armies, and we will talk about why it hurts
so much.
Have a great night, folks.
I see you.
I see you, Jake Sully.
Yes. Anyway. good night.
Bye.